Journey to Wellness in Indian Country is made possible by the University of Minnesota Medical School Duluth Campus, serving the needs of rural Minnesota and Native American communities. We are thrilled to have as our special guest this morning, Jody Archambault. She is a member of the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe. She's a former policy advisor during the Obama administration. She was named the special assistant to the president for Native American affairs. Now she is the strategic advisor at the Bush Foundation and the director of Indigenous Peoples Initiatives at the Wend Collective. Jody, good morning, and thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Thanks for having me, Linda.
So I listened to your interview on Democracy Now and had one of those famous public broadcasting driveway moments that people talk about where you're absolutely glued to the radio and you cannot tune away. We've talked a number of times on this program, Northland Morning, about how Native people are at risk due to a variety of health factors from COVID-19 that the majority population is not at risk for. And there's a long, long history about that. I wonder if you could take just a moment or two and kind of recap that in case folks missed any of those previous conversations.
Well, it starts out a long time ago during contact, and there's been a lot that's happened through broken treaties, mostly when it comes to Native American populations. One of the common provisions for a lot of the treaties was a doctor, medical services, and that plays out similarly to the Veterans Administration. It's a federally operated system, the Indian Health Service. It's woefully underfunded. That's a service system that funds primarily the reservation hospitals and clinics and a handful of urban areas. The other part of this is that Native Americans do have higher rates of a lot of the what people have termed industrial diet diseases, such as obesity, high blood pressure, heart disease, and just the general things that happen when you have a industrial diet, indigenous peoples move from subsistence and a really healthy way of living and feeding themselves off the land to a heavily processed foods staple that causes a lot of health problems. So what we have are really high rates of the diseases that are make COVID a lot more deadly than the rest of for the rest of the population. You know, the CDC, the numbers that everybody keeps using, which are probably very old and outdated, but Native Americans, American Indians and Alaska Natives are 2.8 times more likely to be diagnosed with COVID and 5.3 times more likely than whites to be hospitalized and 1.4 times more likely to die from COVID. In North and South Dakota, those numbers are very different, and it's the data is so hard to keep up with because of the two systems, the federal system and the state systems that are up here, and that's the case across the United States. It's really hard to say that those numbers are accurate at this point in time. But the devastating effects on Native Americans as a population, as a specific group in the United States, we've been heavily, heavily hit with COVID, and the effects seem to have a devastating impact on especially our elders. Like the rest of the population, it is hitting our elders the hardest.
One of the things that keeps these numbers, for the most part, from being made public is that percentage-wise, Native Americans are not a large percentage of the population. And, of course, we all got a little taste of that during the election when Native Americans were lumped in as something else. And many folks kind of took that designation and ran with it on social media. So we don't hear a lot of these numbers. But one of the things that created that driveway moment for me, even though it turned out to be a studio moment during about your conversation on Democracy Now!, was that you are losing more than just community members and beloved people when you lose elders in many Native communities. You're losing language. Will you talk about that, please?
So one of the effects of colonialism and the colonialism and structural racism in the United States has caused a myriad number of problems to affect Native Americans at higher rates. One of the things that the effects of colonialism is that there was a policy that started out probably since contact, but really played out in the late 1800s, early 1900s, called assimilation. And the assimilation work of the United States, they spent millions and millions of dollars trying to strip us of our culture. And the motto of Colonel Pratt was kill the Indian and save the man. And so basically the children were taken from their parents, and they were prohibited from speaking their language. And so that's my grandmother, that's my grandfather, those are my ancestors that went through that period of time. I'd say it started at my grandmother and grandfather's generation, so just two generations ago. And it was very successful in changing the way that we teach language to children as a whole, at least in my experience, for Lakota. There are communities that continue to teach their children their indigenous languages, but for a whole host of reasons, the most of our elders who speak the language, or most of the people who speak the language, the Lakota language, are elders. And the average age is around 70 years old. So in the elders' lifetime, this is my father and mother's generation, they've gone, my parents don't speak the language, but a lot of people who are their age still did when they were growing up. And a lot of them grew up with Lakota being their first language. And now we have most of our Lakota speakers across the United States. There's some really scary numbers. Most of them are out of the approximately 170,000 Lakota Dakota people. There are less than 2,000 fluent speakers. So we went from 6,000 fluent speakers in 2000, a decade later in 2010, we only had 2,000 fluent speakers. There haven't been surveys lately, but there's fewer and fewer and fewer Lakota speakers.
Talk a little bit about what up, because again, this is one of those things we don't think about our language. We don't think about how we learned our language. Perhaps people who are lucky enough or clever enough to speak different languages pay more attention to the nuance of language and what language means in our lives. But for many of us, it's kind of like our nose. It's too close to really get a good look at. Talk about what people lose when they lose a language.
So this is the issue with losing the language is that it's really hard for people in the United States to understand, or for people who are a part of the, I guess, the regular mainstream world economy to understand how important these languages are, because there's a view, there's still this hierarchy of people that's ingrained in the way that the school systems teach. For us, the language contains not just how to speak, but how to, it's an entire worldview. It's an entire paradigm that has been developed over millennia. The way that all indigenous languages live in a people is it explains, it gives meaning to the world, and it gives meaning to how people relate to each other, how people relate to place, how people relate to the universe. In that understanding, there are a whole set of complex value systems and ways that people behave toward not just one another, but to Mother Earth. And for us, this is something that a lot of people are in an urgent state of emergency right now to try to save the languages and find ways to get more people in the younger generations to speak the language. Because even if nobody cares, even if there aren't a ton of resources going towards saving these languages, for each, not just Lakota, but for every single indigenous collective peoples on Earth, these are important ways that we organize the world. And it's pretty clear that in the diversity of culture and in the diversity of worldviews, it's very much like if you look at biodiversity. We have to have cultural diversity because we, as a human species, we're more resilient if there are more ways to look at the world than just the European colonial approach. That there's always going to be volumes and importance on the intellectual development of those spaces in Europe, in those spaces of the dominant culture. But in the indigenous peoples realm, last year was declared the Year of Indigenous Languages by the UN. And this year, it happens to be that COVID itself has been just wreaking havoc because of how much of the population in many indigenous communities, the most fluent people are the elders. And it's like that in every culture. As people advance and they develop as human beings, the older they get, the more understanding that they have. And they grow what we call woksape, or wisdom. And so the idea that we can teach everybody this colonial system and we're going to be okay, this colonial system is failing Mother Earth. And so we need to be looking towards other ways of looking at how we're here as a species.
Well, the colonial system in many respects isn't doing any favors to elders either, because there seems to be many people that feel that these folks are disposable and, you know, well, yeah, they were going to die anyway, that sort of thing. Jody, one other thing that you talked about was the efforts that tribal people have undertaken in many communities, including in South Dakota, to keep their communities, keep their elders safe, being very, very aware of all of these factors. They may not be at the front of mind of the dominant culture, but they're very much front of mind on reservations and with many groups of tribal people. And so they have tried to keep people out of the reservations and secure the borders to try to keep their people safe. And they've been getting a lot of pushback. What's the current situation now?
So there are still roadblocks that are protecting the people of Cheyenne River and Pine Ridge. The tribes have set up roadblocks to prohibit unnecessary travel through those nations, and there have been. Disputes with the state government in South Dakota because the state takes the view that they own the highways and that they alone have the ability to restrict traffic. And because the state, the governor there, Kristi Noem, doesn't really believe that people should even have a mask mandate, there's been litigation, there's been threats from the Trump administration regarding the COVID relief dollars against these tribal leaders and their people. But the tribes haven't stopped. They've continued. They've both of the two nations have started early, and they continue to have these roadblocks, and with the understanding that this is not just protecting elders. This is protecting libraries, living libraries of the most precious people, on the planet. From our view, they are the keepers of our language and our ways. This understanding or this value that the tribes have put on the elders and the people, their population, is admirable. It's not just admirable. It's something that is a direct use of their sovereignty to do what a sovereign should do when under threat. And it's something that I think the Chairman Fraser termed very wonderfully on a number of different newscasts, that there's not going to be the federal dollars to the health systems that will make us safer. There's not going to be a new hospital built like they've built in other countries to deal with COVID patients. We will have to, and we've had to, take our patients, our critically ill patients, not only off the reservation, but out of the state, because the state itself has an overflow of critically ill COVID patients. So they knew that. The tribes knew that there was going to be not enough resources in the healthcare system that existed. And so they took this view and were punished.
Jody, thank you so much for taking some time to talk with us about this morning. One final question. Do you hold out any hope that with some of the shakeups and some of the new information that people are getting about health disparities in this country, do you have a sense that maybe this is an opportunity that could be taken advantage of to create some change once we get the immediate danger of the pandemic under control?
I do, with programming like this, because we can't be the only ones asking to be resourced in ways that fit our issues. The budgetary process is something that's controlled by the states and their elected representatives in Congress. And I do think that if more people understood that when they talk to their representative and talk about funding the healthcare system in a way that is responsive and adequate to the needs, then I think there will be change. And I do believe that once people are made aware of this situation, that they can demand of the United States to do a better job. They can be an ally and an advocate. The National Indian Health Board has a number of policy proposals that, if people want to understand better how to get behind tribes, there are a lot of proposals at the National Congress of American Indians, and there's policy proposals that they put forward. The local tribes, as people hear about this stuff and they want to get involved, if they have a nation that's near, to start getting behind them, and even expecting their governors and even expecting their state legislatures, their politicians have a voice that hasn't stood behind something like Indian health care traditionally in the past. They kind of just leave us to deal with the federal government on our own. And we need to be in a mandatory funding stream. We can't just be left to the discretionary budgets and the ups and downs of those budgets. We should be put into the same class of care that the rest of the United States is put in at the Health and Human Services budget. That we should be in the mandatory. We shouldn't have to worry about the partisan fights. Like, so many Americans don't even know that mandatory means that there's not an argument of whether or not it's funded. This is like defense budget. This is Medicaid, Medicare. We're in the same category of funding as the EPA and the Department of Interior. Our Indian Health Service budget is one of the smallest subcommittees. Their overall budget is less than $20 billion, and you put that against HHS's mandatory budget, which is like over $1 trillion. Like, we're fighting over peanuts with the National Park Service. That's not fair. We're not animals. It's very dehumanizing, and we have to change the way that the United States continues to oppress us and dehumanize us. Now it's through appropriations, and it sounds so complicated that people feel like they're paralyzed. But if we would just get behind and start pushing generally elected leaders to prioritize our health care needs. And no, we're different. We have unique systems in place. It's more like the veterans' health care, which is also very plagued with a lot of issues. This isn't really a race to the bottom in terms of who has it worse. But we do have less funding per individual than inmates in prison. And so we can't continue down this path. We can't. We really, as a country, I think that people are once informed, become really good advocates and do care and do want to make a difference. So yeah, I have hope. There's more awareness. I think there needs to be more messaging and understanding on what people can do and how to ask their representatives to prioritize it.
Jody, we'll get some links set up when we post this article to the web so that folks can go to some of these places that you've talked about and educate themselves, get some more information. And if they're interested in becoming allies, they'll have an idea, a place or two that they can start. Thank you again so much, Jody, for joining us this morning as our guest.
Thank you for having me.
Jody Archambault, our guest this morning on Journey to Wellness in Indian Country. She is a strategic advisor at the Bush Foundation. She's the director of Indigenous Peoples Initiatives at the Wend Collective, and she was the special assistant to the president for Native American Affairs during the Obama administration. Journey to Wellness in Indian Country is made possible by the University of Minnesota Medical School Duluth Campus, an emerging center of rural American Indian and Indigenous health research.